Well, hi there, folks. Fred Reno here, your host and founder of the Fine Wine Confidential podcast. In my latest episode, number 6 of All About Virginia Norton, I had the pleasure to interview Dr. Bruce Sockland, professor emeritus enology at Virginia Tech. Bruce was teaching enology at UC Davis Fresno when Virginia Tech recruited him back in 1985 to help start up their program. Bruce had had some experience in Missouri with Norton before that and came well equipped to take on the challenges facing the Virginia wine growing community at that time. Bruce has also become a friend and works with me overseeing the Norton Cup Challenge judging I started at the Homestead Resort in Hot Springs, Virginia in 2022. You will enjoy his insights and comments, so let's jump into this interview.
The evolution of the Virginia wine industry is nothing short of staggering.
Yeah.
It really, really is. I mean, as I've mentioned to you repeatedly, in 1985, nor I nor anyone else would have ever guessed the industry would be as developed as it is now, or and how it started. To say embryonic is, as I've mentioned before, an understatement of enormous magnitude.
Well, that's a good jumping off spot. Let's jump into this interview. That was where I was going to begin this. So it was in 1985 that you were recruited. You were teaching at Davis Fresno Enology, correct?
Yes.
And then you came back to Virginia. That's almost 50 years ago, Bruce. So the question I have as it relates to Norton, had you ever had any experience with Norton before you came to Virginia?
Yeah. When I was teaching at Fresno State, students of mine were the sons and daughters, two sons, one daughter of winery owner in Missouri. Hmm. And they had introduced me to Norton. And indeed, I ended up coming out and staying with them one Christmas just to check out their operation, which was and is quite substantive. That's Stonehill.
Oh, so it was Stonehill. So you were right at the best to begin with.
Yeah, yeah. And indeed, I got so enamored with what they were doing, Norton and otherwise, that I did take a job at the University of Missouri for a while in a development program there.
Very interesting.
I had pretty good indoctrination to Norton. And Norton, of course, was at the time the primary grape that really had some aging potential for the Missouri wine industry. It was their sort of answer to vinifera. And so it got a fair amount of attention, even in those early days. I think it was easily recognized. It was relatively unique.
So when you came to Virginia, Dennis Horton hadn't opened his operation yet, had he?
Oh, no. Dennis, I came in 85. Dennis didn't get rolling until into the 90s.
Yeah, okay. So had you spoke to him before he went to Missouri to get cuttings and bring Norton back?
Oh, yeah.
Did he contact you?
Yes.
What did he say? I'd be curious.
this first contact was just to let me know he was here.
Okay.
And he started coming to the meetings, a very inquisitive guy. He wasn't the type of person you ignored. Asked a lot of questions and was engaged. I mean, I didn't have the impression early on that his focus was exclusively Norton, of course. He
right.
was trying to learn about the Virginia wine industry.
Oh, yeah, just in general. As it relates to Norton, is there, in your opinion, an ideal climate for Norton to grow?
Well, I think Norton has some unique advantages, mainly due to our ever-changing climate. So if you look at, say, sustainability, which has many facets, particularly in the case of the common vernacular, that term, which is environmental sustainability,
right.
Norton is somewhat unparalleled because compared to vinifera, Norton is not susceptible to black rot, botrytis, powdery mildew, and is only marginally susceptible to downy mildew. Therefore, of course, that you have less spray material, which obviously affects, among other things, your bottom line. The other thing about Norton that I think is particularly germane with regard to climate and sustainability is that it's very winter hardy. And you don't have to have your ear too close to the rail to realize how important that might be. Just look at what's happened to the British Columbia wine industry.
Oh, right.
Two successive freezes, and 30% of those wineries are going out of business.
Wow.
And the other aspect with climate and climate change is this increase in carbon dioxide level. The carbon dioxide level increase is resulting in a lessening of the diurnal temperature spread.
Mm.
Diurnal being, of course, the difference between day and night temperature. That affects the anthocyanin pigments in the grape. The lower that diurnal temperature is, the less anthocyanins are generally produced. And there is a positive direct correlation between the anthocyanin content in a red wine. Anthocyanin is, of course, the pigment, red pigment. There's a direct positive correlation between the anthocyanin content and the and wine quality. So in the case of Norton, Norton has is very well endowed with anthocyanins. Academic way of suggesting it has no shortage of color. That color is quite important in selling red wine. So it's a significant.
It has no lack of color. That's for sure. Well, this chemical that you're referring to, it's somehow connected to better heart health, I read somewhere.
Anthocyanins?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, yes, in the case of Norton's phenolic chemistry in general is different than vinifera. Mm-hmm. The anthocyanins, for example, 40% of them are attached to sugar molecules, which means that they are very soluble. Water matrix, such as juice, that's how it is that as soon as you crush the grape, you get a lot of color dissolved. But they do have some botanical and nutraceutical benefits, no question about that. But the other aspect, I think, that's important with regard to this idea of sustainability is economic sustainability.
Right.
Of course, I mean, it's like that old line about go ask a farmer what he would do if he inherited $1 million. He'd continue to farm until he ran out of money.
Right. Okay.
And in this day and age, that's not going to take very long. I think one of the interesting things about Norton is to see how that relates to the other varieties that we have in the mix. You know, many European vintners realize that their sustainability is linked very directly to the ability to express terroir of their site. And, of course, the concept of terroir is the belief that a wine grower can produce a wine that has some sort of unique or inherited expression of character from either the vineyard site or the vintage. So in the age of ever-increasing competition, terroir becomes, I think, important in the marketplace. So in the case of Norton, you've got a wine that is traditionally marketed based on its varietal. But I think in the future, we may be wanting to look at the relationship between site and the expression of character from Norton. And that's something that hasn't really been done to any great degree. And I don't think too many people have thought about that with regard to Norton, not in the past anyway, now that we're a little bit more attuned to this variety because of the demonstrated production of fairly high-quality Nortons. Some people are thinking about this. When I was thinking about this idea of Norton and terroir, I was thinking about that Taoist expression that suggests a fish can't see water unless it jumps out of the bowl, meaning that we get sort of programmed in a certain kind of thought dimension and don't always take those blinders off to look around. So if you have a variety whose primary expression is simply a function of the cultivar, which is what we have presumed that Norton is, then it should be marketed based on the name of the cultivar. If, however, the combination of soil, climate, and other terroir features affect the variety, then it probably should be marketed not simply based on the name of the cultivar, but also with regard to the region or maybe the specific site. Specific
the vineyard. Site. Well, you know, Bruce, let me stop you there because that ties into something that has my memory bank going around. As I think I told you before, the last glass of red wine I have every night without fail is a glass of Norton. And I'll open a bottle of some producer, have a glass, put the cork back in, put it in the refrigerator, and go back and forth to it over 3, 4, 5 nights. And I've been doing this for over a year and a half now, so that there's been a broad spectrum. And I've started to notice what you're referring to, where I'm going, okay, this wine is much higher quality than that producer's. Why is it? Is it the site? Is it their technique? Is it a combination of both? And then also what I'm picking up from some the growers who are getting into it now is sort of like, well, like Dennis Horton gave Scott Ellis some advice to me when he started his vineyard. He said, well, here, you can just put it down in that part of the vineyard. It's going to do just fine. But it seems to me now people are starting to take a look at what spots within their vineyard might be better suited for Norton and starting to plant there. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are somewhat broad brush from what I've said. I think that if we're going to get the maximum benefit from this cultivar, then we need to look at it in the context of terroir expression. And that is to say, what is the relationship between the site and what we get in the glass, the sensory features that we get in the glass? Mm-hmm. And we could presume that there would be some differences. And there's libraries full of literature about vinifera that suggest, you know, high calcium soils, this, that, and the other differences, but we have nothing that of that with regard to Norton. And I think that as we look at the evolution of Norton in the future, which is kind of my point, I think looking at this terroir feature in Norton will be important.
As I understand it, speak to this piece of Norton. As I understand it, unlike a lot of vinifera and other grapes, it's a real seed pocket. And so the amount of juice you get out of a ton of Norton is fairly reduced to other grapes. Is that accurate?
Entirely accurate. And the benefits that Norton has viticulturally, relatively non-susceptibility to the fungal diseases that I mentioned and the winter hardiness is in some people's minds offset by the one low yield and two, the fact that it's hard to be terribly minimalistic in winemaking with Norton because frequently you have to do some more zigging and zagging than it's not like that expression that God makes the wine. You have to be God. You have to be the intervener here.
Oh, very interesting.
And yeah, that actually does circle back to economic sustainability. That's one of the reasons why I think not everybody has been a full adapter to Norton because it's difficult to produce. And its juice yield is not what you would get in a vinifera.
Well, that's what I understood. What is from your experience, from a trellising standpoint, in growing Norton in the vineyard? Is there an ideal trellis, or is that also just sort of dependent on the site?
The overall important variable is the site. But having said that, generally, because Norton is fairly vigorous, you generally want to minimize too much leaf shading. Norton has a tendency to produce a high level of malic acid, and if you have too many leaves, more than 3 leaves deep, you get a phenomenon known as phloem loading, which essentially means that in this case that you have a higher malic acid content.
Right.
And so you have a grape that has intrinsically a high malic acid content, and too much leaf shading leaves is going to exacerbate that problem. So therefore, you want some sort of either split canopy or some mechanism whereby to minimize excessive leaf shading.
Well, that's interesting because Julian Durante, the winemaker at Ducard, was talking about that in my interview with them. And he referred to this term that I had never heard before until Chris Hill mentioned to me in an interview early on. I'm going to butcher it, but moxipyrene?
Methoxypyrazine. Moxipyrazine are it's that character that we used to produce a lot in our Cabernet Francs. It's this green bell pepper kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's not a particularly dominant feature in Norton, not nearly like it is in Cabernet Franc and some Cabernet Sauvignons.
Well, do you think that compound itself is what some people may mistake for what they call Norton Foxy?
I think that term has been, it's almost like minerality. It's whatever you want to believe it to be. The term Foxy, and I noticed that Todd Kleiman made a reference to this not infrequently in his book. It doesn't really apply to Norton, in my opinion, because the term Foxy was originally applied to hybrid wines, primarily as a moniker for methylanthralinate, which is this sort of Concord grape kind of smell.
Okay.
And that's not, I think, particularly apropos for Norton.
Yeah, I don't get
Norton
it.
Norton has some of its own characteristics, but it depends on, one, how it was made, and two, particularly its age.
Yeah, I don't get it out of Norton, but I hear some people who don't have a lot of experience tasting Norton say it's foxy, and I keep thinking to myself, well, I don't get that.
That's just a term that people had used to describe the fact that it doesn't smell or taste like a vinifera.
Right. Okay. Well, and another thing that ties to that, too, is a number of people mistake, in my opinion now, that high malic content in the wine as tannin. And we both know that Norton is a relatively low tannin wine by its sure makeup, correct?
Well, there's a little bit of a fallacy there because tannin, the term tannin is a broad brushed term. What they're referring to are astringent tannins. Now, when we measure tannins in a wine, we measure two types: protein precipitatable tannins, which are the astringent type tannins, to which Norton generally doesn't have a whole lot, versus iron reactive tannins, which are much higher. Norton doesn't have a lot of astringent tannins, but as you alluded to, the berry is a small, essentially seed pack. Mm-hmm. Those seeds have a high level of gallic tannins, low molecular weight tannins that collectively are both bitter and astringent and can be astringent. So it depends on how the wine is made. There can be plenty of Nortons that are astringent, either in part because of the extraction of seed tannins or because people add enological tannins to the wine. And that's not uncommon. Those are natural products. It's not like folks are adding something that is totally out of line. It's a common
thing. No, I follow what you're saying. I think people have a misnomer about wine, as you said earlier, making itself. This is winemaking. It's alchemy. Yeah. There's certain techniques, you know, traditional and not so traditional that people use.
One of the real problems with Norton is palate balance. And when I speak of palate balance, you have to have a relative harmony between the sense of sweetness and the sum of the perception and sense of acidity and a sense of bitterness and astringency. They also don't realize that the acids in the wine will magnify the sense of astringency and bitterness. So in the case of Norton, where you might have a level of malic acid and you might have some background bitterness and or astringency, both of those features can be amplified, thereby making the wine disbalanced.
Hey, I want to lighten this up a little bit and have you tell that story that you told me some time ago about when you came to Virginia and you put together a tasting for a number of winemakers and vintners, blind tasting, and they went into the whole guessing game. Can you revisit that and tell me how that came together and the story behind it?
Well, it was my indoctrination meeting, that is to say the first extension meeting that I had here, and it happened to be down here on the campus of Virginia Tech.
Okay.
It was a two-day meeting. I don't even remember the specific nature of the meeting, but we had the 31 or so producers were all represented. Usually at that time, the owners and the winemakers were one and the same, not in all cases, but pretty much. And because it was a small group, relatively speaking, of 31 or so folks, I decided to have them over my house for a social after the first day. And so we're at my place. It's late afternoon, and we're doing a barbecue. And before that, I decided to play the bag game. I decided to do for them what people have done for me that I used to hate, and that is to bag up some wines and ask them to taste those wines blindly and tell me all the nuances, the cultivar, the region, the vintage, the winemaker, and whether the winemaker had a 3-foot stride or 4-foot stride, the whole biz. And so I had Norton's from Missouri, from Stonehill, Missouri, that I had brought, and it was a vertical tasting. 72, 74, 76.
Oh, so they had a fair amount of bottle age on them at that point, too.
Yeah. Yeah, and this was 86. This was 1986. I did tell them that it was a vertical. They could have figured that out. I told them it was the same cultivar in the whole lineup. But I let them taste it, and I let them talk among themselves to see if they could get a consensus after the first round of guessing. And I remember the guesses because they were really kind of interesting to me, as were the wines, because the older wines, the 72, 74, had this sort of Bordelais cigar box character, which is very alluring, very appealing. That was, I guess, the primary reason why they had presumed that these were Bordelais wines, and so I did get the smattering of left bank versus right bank guesses, and I joked with them at the time that their imagination might have been greater than their knowledge. There was only one producer there that I recall had ever tasted Norton before, and so it's not that surprising that they would not have guessed correctly.
Right.
But it was rather flattering, and I related this to John Held at Stonehill, rather flattering that they thought that they were drinking a Bordelais wine. They were quite astounded.
That's been my experience, Bruce, when I've had the good pleasure to be able to taste older Norton wines, 10, 15-year-old wines. They do take on a character, at least the ones I've had, that's like a classified growth Bordeaux for the most part.
You know, if we'd ever gotten any funding for it, I would have loved to have done some aging studies because we did some artificial aging with some things. But we never did it for Norton to the degree that I think it should be viewed because, again, circling back to this economic sustainability.
Right.
If we all agree that age Norton is much better than young Norton, and we further agree that aging wine in your cellar for a couple of years before you release it is probably not economically viable for many, then developing some practice whereby you could ramp up the speed by which the wine evolves would certainly be advantageous.
Well, that's an interesting thought and concept, that's for sure. By the way, thank you again for helping me put on the Norton Cup Challenge at the Homestead, 2 years running now. Did you perceive a little different approach from the judges this past year than the very first year?
Maybe a greater appreciation for the wines.
Okay.
I wouldn't say a different approach because the methodology was the same.
Right.
Maybe given the relativity of perceptions, maybe that's incorrect on my part, but it seemed to me that their appreciation for the wine quality might have been a little bit greater this time.
Well, I felt that as well. And talking to them, I felt they had taken it a little bit more seriously, which leads me to that kind of moniker I've heard a lot when I first came here the first couple of years, when I talked to people about Norton, and they would say, well, you know, as Mike Henney said to me in an interview, he said, Norton parts the ways here in Virginia. You either love it or you hate it. Where did that come from? How did that develop, that kind of you either love it or you hate it?
I think from several dimensions. First, young Norton sensorially is not like a vinifera, and it's not what most people are used to drinking. I don't know if that reflects how open-minded people are or their own personal preferences, probably a little bit of both. But the other hated part may come from some producers who, while having a fairly easy time in the vineyard, realize it's a struggle in the cellar.
I think you broke the code for me with that comment, because I've gotten that from other winemakers. Well, it's just so much work in the cellar.
Yeah, and not only the direct work, but again, you got to age this stuff to really have a wine that has a broad breadth of appeal, in my opinion.
Well, that makes me think anecdotally back to when I really got on this Norton journey a few years ago, and I pulled out a bottle of a 2008 Chrysalis Estate Norton for a Mother's Day dinner at our house for my wife, who didn't like Norton at all. And when she asked, what are we having tonight? And I said, well, we're going to have this Chrysalis Norton. She says, you know, I don't really care for Norton. I said, trust me on this. And so I decanted the wine and served it. And halfway through the decanter, she looks at me, Bruce, and goes, man, this is really good. Do we have any more of this?
Yeah, yeah.
And it reminded me of an old sort of almost a ringer for a well-aged Chateau Latour, if you can believe that. And then the next week, I said, okay, I'm going to try something else. So I had a 2009 Norton, decanted it. And halfway through the bottle, I looked at my wife and I said, this is really perplexing. This wine tastes like a really high quality Village Pommard. Can this grape really do that? Can it one time taste like a Burgundy and another one like a Bordeaux? Have you had any kind of experience like that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing to me that it has that versatility and flavor profile once it gets bottle age.
It is remarkable. We've looked at the phenols, but not studied the volatiles from Norton. A lot of those esters diminish, and that's why it goes from that sort of almost burnt cinnamon kind of character to something with a lot more complexity with bottle aging. And that's really, I think, the name of the game. In order to get around that, the time lag between production and having it have a broader breadth of appeal, several to many have ended up blending vinifera in with it.
Right.
Which is, that's certainly their right. I don't think that you can understand the expression of a site or a cultivar by doing that, because what you end up with in the bottle is not really easy to separate out the variables that way.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Well, there's just more research, obviously, practical research needs to go on and experimentation.
I think that'll only occur by in-house work by the few people that are committed to Norton. I don't see any other way of answering these questions. It's not like you can get from a big funding or even a small funding agency a grant to work on Norton. I don't think that'll happen anytime soon. Unless, unless, of course, we were to get a couple of Clipper freezes in Virginia and really clobber the vinifera, then Norton status would increase dramatically, I suspect.
Well, the one what I'm going to call live laboratory for experimentation, you know it well, is Chrysalis. Look at all the many different styles of Norton that Jenny's been producing over the years.
Well, in the past, the what we did to try and share the knowledge was I hosted a number of Norton roundtables, and we got the Norton producers together frequently at Jenny's, and we tasted wines blindly and had open discussions about the production practices and philosophies of Norton. That was in the early days, and I think that actually helped to propel the interest on the part of some to many that are in this to pursue it.
Well, to your point here, I don't know whether you're aware or not, and you're probably going to be in Florida, but I got wind talking to Shep Ross that the Virginia Wineries Association annual conference
is doing having a
Norton thing.
Yeah, Shep's going to be there. Phil Ponton is going to moderate it.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's a growers thing. But yeah, no, I was pleased to see that.
Yeah, that's
unfortunately, I'm going to be out of town, out of state.
Well, and then the other thing is, Frank Morgan, who's now taken over running the Governor's Cup, as you know, he told me they got a handful of entries for Norton this year for the first time in a number of years.
Well, so, you can take some credit for that for sure.
Well, you know, there just seems to be a movement going on here where people are starting to pay much more attention to
Norton. As soon as someone steps out and starts consistently making highly palatable wines, people look around, and now you've got more than just one or two people making highly palatable Norton. So we've got a little bit of a mini groundswell, so to speak. It's it used to be just Jenny and Dennis and maybe, you know, Keswick once in a while or a few others. Now it's there's others, and the quality standards have gone up. I have to say, you know, in some of the early days, some of the Nortons had a high VA or volatile acidity and had some other less than spectacular enological nuances. Not true now.
Well, yeah, I haven't really encountered that myself, so that's a really good point. Could you weigh in a little bit about this ongoing controversy? And as we both know, an individual who's trying to bring some sort of clarity to this thing between Cynthiana the grape and Norton the grape, and how they're related or unrelated?
Well, they're certainly related. Morphologically, they're different. So that is to say, physically, they're different. So you would presume that there would be some difference. Cluster size, peduncle length, cluster compactness. In the early days, people called their variety either Norton or Cynthiana, not based on what necessarily the nursery had to say when they delivered the vines, but what they thought was a more appealing marketing term, Norton versus Cynthiana. And so you had a lot of mix-up there, which clouded the issue. Bruce Reich and some others in Geneva did some early work looking to try and see if there were some differences. At that time, the only way that was easy to categorize or determine, rather, if there were differences, was looking at the protein mix, what they called isobanding. It didn't suggest any big differences, but that was relatively crude. And so the literature has kind of bounced back and forth. And because until recently, nobody really cared.
Right. Good point.
I think this sort of obscure little cocktail party tidbit was not an issue. Now that people are more serious about this, it would be nice to get this resolved. I don't doubt that there is a difference.
Yeah, no, that seems to me, based on what I've tasted, I'll give you a good example. It's a Lucy Morton client, that's Cassonelle Vineyards. When I had their Norton, it just seemed a lot more elegant in its youth than some of the others. And she says that a very large majority of that vineyard, on her observation, is planted to what she would call a Cynthiana grape. All right, that makes some sense. The wine's a little lighter, a bit more elegant in its youth, but still brawny wine, as we both know. And it showed well both years at the Homestead. It's finished in the top four 2 years in a row at the Homestead Norton Cup Challenge. And by the way, that 53rd Winery and Vineyard Norton, the 2021, that, you know, topped the field this year, that was my last glass of red wine all last week. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that wine is good. That was a good choice. Rock solid wine, just really, and developed every night.
Yeah, that's another advantage of Norton. It has and we did look at the antioxidant capacity, which is a function of both the cultivar and how it's made. To your point, you can open up a bottle of Norton and it will not fade on you very quickly.
Yeah.
That is to say, you can open it up and drink it for a week and it's still vibrant.
Yeah, no, that's been my experience.
It has what the Chinese would call qi, you know, that life force.
It's my passion, as you know, and that's what this podcast episodes are all about, is to bring awareness to a larger audience to, at a minimum, get them to have some intellectual curiosity and seek it out and decide for themselves. You know, that's the one thing, just in general terms, that I've seen now after 45 years in the wine business. It, and looking at the consumer side of this, but also the trade side, there just seems to me to be a big lack of intellectual curiosity about wine, unlike when I got in the business in the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s. There was just a deeper intellectual curiosity about wine from different regions, what wine's like. And I just don't see that passion that much anymore.
I think that that has diminished. Perhaps it correlates with diminished concern about alcohol. I'm not sure.
Oh, interesting.
But the real diminution seems to be in wine sales and on-site sales, which might correlate with this lack of intellectual curiosity.
Well, I hadn't thought about it from that standpoint. But as long as you brought up the social piece of this, I don't know that the wine business is fully awake, the industry. There's a sort of backdoor, what I'm going to call neo-prohibition thing happening, and nobody's paying much attention.
Well, I think people are paying attention. They're just kind of they're whining about it, but I don't know what they're a little bit unfocused as what could possibly be done.
Well, that's true too, but I think, this is my opinion again, wine needs to get out there and separate itself in the consumer's mind from beer and alcohol and liquor.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that the wine industry needs to highlight the food complement and the agricultural nature of this. And I think there is a great deal of interest in agriculture. I think that there is an increased awareness of the importance of agriculture, of the role of the farming community in our society, and our industry has, I think, some unique things to say about that. And I have to think that that could be promoted more strongly to buffer up the interest, that is to say, highlighting the food complement nature and the agricultural nature, and stepping away from the alcoholic beverage part of it.
Well, that
I think
is a good
that
point.
Obviously there's the, I mean, the big trend is for lower alcohol. I don't think that we're going to be in a position of making a big dent in totally non-alcoholic wines like the beer industry has.
Well, that's a good point.
We can offset that because I think that the beer industry doesn't have the agricultural component that we do.
Right.
In that the brewers, they're not out there growing the grain. It's not the same sort of personal lifestyle commitment that you get.
Well, yeah, you don't have a vintage. You don't have this vintage variance.
Right.
You know, one other component about this that I think is the biggest challenge from my perspective, I got introduced to wine 45 plus years ago because of a dining experience. And today, societally, especially the younger people, they just don't dine anymore. They eat a lot of different foods. They're eating on the run, on the go. It's wine is part of that whole dining social interaction.
Yeah.
You know, and absent of that culture, which is more European in nature and family structure, we've got a challenge here that's even bigger in some regards to introduce people to wine in the proper setting.
I agree. A lot of this, I think, be addressed with more education. I'm not sure. But certainly not having some of these influencers peddling incorrect knowledge or facts would be helpful.
Speaking of which, I think I mentioned this to you before, but there's so much misinformation about Norton. And a good example is if you go on the Wine Searcher website, which is a good website. I mean, it's a very useful one for people who want to see where they could buy certain wines in different stores and places all over the country. But they also have a good, reasonably put together educational component. And even to this day, unless they're listening to my podcast where I'm calling them out, they say on there that Norton was discovered in Missouri, which is 100% inaccurate. So I suspect they'll change that at some point.
Yeah. Well, relative to the degree of misinformation out there with regard to wine, that's a kind of a minor feature.
I know, but for me, it's major. So that's like I glommed onto it, right?
Yeah. Well, I get it.
Well, hey, Bruce, I'm going to stop the recording of this and then we can just catch up here. Well, folks, whenever I spend time with Bruce Stockland, I never fail to learn something new. His grasp of the challenges producing wine from the Norton grape is obviously very great and a good example. Bruce continues to be a tremendous asset to the Virginia wine industry, and although he has stepped back from a full-time role at Virginia Tech, I don't see him slowing down anytime soon. So get ready for the next episode, number 7. I'm very excited to have you tune in on this one. I interview Jason Murray, the owner and winemaker at Artera Winery located in Plains, Virginia. Jason is every bit as up on wine growing in Virginia as anyone and brings a unique approach to his efforts in growing and producing some of the most exciting and compelling wines in Virginia. His first vintage at Norton was the 2020. And from what I have tasted recently, including the barrel sample of 2023 he brought to my studio for this interview, it will not be long before his Norton is recognized as among the best yet available from Virginia, albeit in small amounts. You don't want to miss this insightful episode. And again, thank you for taking the time to be on my journey to explore, educate, drink, and enjoy the wines produced from the Norton grape. Any questions or comments, you know where to get me. Send them to Fred at finewineconfidential.com. See you on the other side. Music at Fine Wine Confidential podcast by Jason Shaw at audionautics.com from his copyrighted song Acoustic Shuffle under Creative Commons Attribution
4.0 international license. I hope you enjoyed the show.